Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. Ian Yip is the founder and CEO of Avertro, a venture-backed startup that helps teams manage and measure their cybersecurity performance.
Security people sometimes think we know best. By sometimes, I mean all the time. We always sit there lamenting the fact people aren't listening to us and why is it so hard to get people to care, etc., etc. But if you leave your ego at the door, then you're more willing to listen to what's going to move the needle.
I really enjoyed this conversation. We spoke about how being a salesperson is a valuable skill for any security professional, the common fallacy in software of if you build it, they will come, the similarities between starting a company and having kids, and plenty more. Whether you're an industry veteran or just entering the world of AppSec, I'm sure this episode will have something valuable for you. Let's jump right in. Welcome, Ian. How are you going, mate?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries. Just to get started, I usually ask all my guests, what kind of bird are you and why?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, my little one's currently reading Harry Potter for the first time, so I guess an owl is a good one. They're known for being wise. I don't know if that's factual, but that's the stereotype. At the same time, they're a bird of prey, and they're also quite predatory, you know, in a good way, right? I think they're strong. They're strong and they can make decisions and they're wise. So I like those qualities. Maybe not the predatory part, but but the positive side of it.
I was going to say, like, probably don't want to be jumping on a podcast saying, yeah, man, I'm a bit predatory. It's like just... I think the history of the owl is in a lot of... Because it's basically, it's a nocturnal animal.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of, I guess, ancient mythology, so both Norse and Greek, it was always associated with wisdom. So I think that that's just permeated through history. And nowadays, we're always assuming the owls are associated with wisdom because they were back then.
And actually, you do bring up a good point. I think back from when I was in uni, I used to stay up late doing assignments and things. And that probably hasn't changed. I'm still sometimes up at, not that I'm encouraging everyone to be up at midnight doing work, but that does still happen sometimes. So I am nocturnal, and sometimes I do my most efficient work at midnight as a force of habit.
That's probably a good thing is like I have kids, and so I find that the best situation for me is either really early in the morning or really late at night, because like my baby's going to be asleep and my daughter's going to be just, you know, basically crashing around 8 or 9 o'clock, and then I got a few hours to smash stuff out, or I get up early in the morning. Problem is, it's too bloody cold in the morning.
Yeah, now winter, it is, but you got to work your life into there as well, and if that's the way you got to work it, that's the way you got to work it.
So whereabouts are you located?
I'm usually in Sydney, Australia, but this year I've been around the place. I've been in the US a little bit. I've got a trip to Singapore coming up. I'll be in the US again at least 2 more times this year. So that's usually the way I've answered the question. I'm supposed to be in Sydney, but doesn't mean I'm always here.
So like, you're traveling around a fair bit. Is that because of your company then?
Yes, it's work related. I think in one of my prior roles, I've had corporate roles in the past, and the more recent ones were fairly regional, meaning I wasn't playing lots. So obviously, we had the pandemic in 2020 that stopped all travel. Hmm. So I didn't travel at all, obviously, like most people in 2020, not really in 2021. But as the world has got back to the new normal, not the old normal, I think we've been able to travel a little bit more. And for what we do, I think it's helpful, especially if we're talking about expansion and business-related reasons. You kind of need to be at different places. And I've made it a point, or we made it a point, to expand our wings, so to speak, like an owl, this year. So yeah, I've been traveling a lot more in 2023.
I've been seeing a lot of founders I know locally, at least Laura and Peter, if you know both of those, and even Susie.
Yep.
They all go traveling a fair bit for work as well. So
yeah,
that's probably a good segue, actually, is maybe you could tell us a bit about your background and how you came to becoming a company founder yourself.
My background. So about 20 years in security. I was a graduate at IBM straight out of university. I have a computer science degree, also for engineering degree. So I've been technical from way back. I obviously did learn a little bit of security, but back then it wasn't called cybersecurity. It wasn't even called information security. It was just called networking security or IT security or whatever you call it, right? Yeah. It was IT. And I think like a lot of people who've been in security for a little while, I kind of fell into it by accident. I was doing the grad rotation thing at IBM, and various things were interesting, various things were not. I think IBM, in their foresight back then, saw that security was going to be an up-and-coming thing. They started a security consulting practice, and they were obviously looking for a lot of people to join that, given the work that was coming up. And I heard about it, I put my hand up. I think this is one of the lessons I learned very early on. If you don't put your hand up and you don't actively go seek something, it's probably ain't going to happen. So I went to look for the hiring manager and said, hey, I'm a grad, I'm interested. I hear looking for people. Security seems interesting. Can I join the team? So they went, yeah, you seem like a smart enough guy. You're proactive. Sure, come join a team. And next thing you know, I'm in the security consulting practice at IBM. That's how I fell into it. And that's how I got my start in security properly.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny because I had a similar situation myself because I graduated from my university in like 2011, 12-ish. I can't remember the exact date. And then I just did like freelance software engineering for a few years until I got into a grad program at the ATO.
Yep.
And I did like three rotations. The first rotation was in an agile software development world where I learned things like stand-ups where people would turn up and then move like punch cards on the wall around randomly. And
yeah.
Then they realized there was a thing called Jira. So like a few years later. And then eventually I moved into a contact center rotation, which was, funnily enough, one of the reasons I actually know my taxation stuff fairly well at this point is they made everybody do like a month of like sitting there on the phones taking calls from people around tax time. So I think it's a bit ingenious, honestly, that you get people to like graduates as a way to get extra labor during the period when it's really stressful and there's like, you know, a lot more demand on the tax system. And then the graduates finish up when that disappears just around August.
Yeah.
And then I moved into cyber. So I got into an AppSec team. So it's kind of funny that when I joined that team, almost everybody left. So
how?
Because, yeah.
Not through your doing, obviously, right?
I joined and I was like, hey guys, I'm here. And they're like, yep, we're going. See ya. Nah, they went to go create a SOC. So they just picked up that whole team and pushed it somewhere else. And they said, well, we still need an AppSec function. So Cole, you can lead it.
Okay.
And I'm just like, okay, sure. I guess I'll figure out what AppSec is. And then it's funny, the deep end is really good. It's a good place to be. So you learn a lot. But yeah, man, there's grad programs. I really encourage people all the time to go give them a go. Just like, even being able to understand a lot of different parts of an organization instead of just saying like, I'm the cyber guy, I work in cyber, and then not understanding how the development team works or the risk team or the policy and governance teams or like even accounts payable, receivable or HR, just being able to move around the organization and meet different people really does matter, I think. And that's what grad programs did for me.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's one of the good things about a bigger company. Obviously, we now run smaller companies, but I think we have to be quite realistic about things. A bigger company like the ATO or IBM, they do give you that ability to probably get your fingers in a lot of stuff that maybe you wouldn't get otherwise. So it's depending on your stage of life, I think it served both of us well. So that's something we have to be grateful for.
You did say something interesting there, which is that you have to always put your hand up. I've always felt that that's the case as well. I actively seek and say, hey, I like this person. I want to go talk to them and just say hello. And not necessarily anything will come out of it. But I figure that if you don't do that kind of stuff, then you're not going to really. There's this like common trope I see with software engineers called, if you build it, they will come.
Yep.
So we're going to focus on building the best product available. And then that's it. It's the best. So that I know that doesn't work.
No, it absolutely doesn't work. If you talk about entrepreneurial journeys, right, people ask, is this the first company you've ever started? I kind of dipped my toe, so to speak, in the waters 10 years ago. And I think that naivety when you're a little bit younger does play a part from a technical background. I did think as well, if you build it, they will come. But if you don't realize that you've got to actually sell things and there's a good market in there, you've got to market things, you've got to know how to do all that, both from a business standpoint and a personal standpoint. More recently, we hired a grad into our team earlier in the year. We weren't actually hiring for the grad, and to the point we're making around, you could have put your hand up. He just sent me a cold message out of nowhere saying, this is why I'm great for the company. I know this about a company. I heard about you. I like to do ABC. I'm aligned with your values, and please have a chat to me. And now he works in our team. And that wasn't a headcount we had because he put his hand up. And I was smart enough to realize that, you know, he had all the qualities we want and he'd somebody we want to bring on board.
Yeah, I really encourage people, just go out there, like, don't be obnoxious and just, like, message everyone on LinkedIn constantly. But if there is something that you are willing to give it a go, you know, people are generally relatively friendly in cybersecurity. I know there's the occasional bad egg, but, you know, what's the worst case is they reject you, you know, so you need to just move on with your life.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, going back to your entrepreneurial journey, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes myself running a consultancy business. Like, initially, let's just say that I've never done consulting prior to starting a consultancy business. So that's been a really good learning curve. So I imagine that for yourself, moving into a product company from cyber consultant would have been interesting too, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've worked for product company in the past. Obviously, I've done various kinds of roles. I was at EY, I was McAfee for a little while. Obviously, McAfee is more of a product company. EY is pure consulting.
Hmm.
So I've run the gamut of different things. I always like to say every role I've ever done is a training course to do what I currently do. You were talking earlier about being the ATO and learning about accounting and all kinds of things that have nothing to do with security. Not that I worked the ATO, but I think there were various bits of different roles that I had to pick up skills that maybe weren't naturally about technology or security. There's a lot of leadership management things that you pick up along the way. But talking about starting a company, I think those things serve me in good stead. I know how to do various things. Not that I know all the answers, but there are various things I just naturally know how to do that I didn't realize would be useful in terms of running a startup, particularly one that that is focused on delivering a piece of software to the industry.
So what kind of skills would have you been able to pick up in your career that have helped you with Avertro?
I think the most important one is how to sell.
Yep.
People always realize a little bit too late that selling is an art form. It's not as easy as everybody thinks. And if you can't sell it, well, you can't keep a company going, whether you're doing professional services or you're selling a physical product or a piece of software. Learning to sell is one of the most useful skills anyone can learn. And early on in my career, I didn't think I wanted to be a salesperson. But as I got into trying to grow my own skill set, I realized I wanted to round them out a little bit more than what I was learning early on. And I think you used the word you seek different things. But I like to say, I like being comfortably uncomfortable. So you're always looking for something that you don't really know how to do, but you realize along the way that you will need it. It will serve you in good stead moving forward. Sales is one of those skills. Leadership obviously is something that's really important when you're starting a company. You're leading the company. You're leading yourself. You need to self-motivate. No one's telling you what to do. If you don't do it, it doesn't happen. If you don't motivate yourself, it doesn't happen. If you don't manage yourself, it doesn't happen. If you extend it to learning to lead a team, I think that's one of the things you learn along the way that's probably a little bit harder to do if you try to start a company like straight out of university, for example. People obviously do it and they learn along the way, but then you end up making more mistakes and you need the buffer to make the mistakes. So ideally, you want to make fewer mistakes once you start a company than other things. And then I think the third most important thing is just patience. Things always take longer than you think they're going to take. And even after you account for the fact they'll take longer, they will probably take longer still. And it's one of the most, I think, useful skills in being an entrepreneur that just you realize that a lot of things you read are the exception and like extreme exception. You hear about companies selling within a year or getting to certain metrics within 6 months. That's not normal. And if you optimize for what you read in the press, whether it comes to entrepreneurialism or business or security, you're setting yourself up for a lot of disappointment.
Lots to unpack there. So I think that sales is something I've had to pick up. I'm naturally a good salesman and I've never really thought of myself that way, but I seem to be able to walk into a room and then come out of it with a statement of work, a purchase order and an invoice, right? So,
yeah.
And I guess that's from being pretty good at my craft, but also being able to listen to what people want and knowing what's the right opportunity and when to walk away from things, you know? And I don't know where I learned this skill. I really don't, because I've pretty much always worked back of house kind of roles, right? I'd say that the only way I could have really picked it up is having to sell application security to engineering teams, right? And there's the whole like, oh yeah, let's just shift left, you know? And then you save money and stuff. So I guess like over time, I would have developed that kind of skill. But I know early on, I used to think that I would be able to just make lots of sales really quickly with just my existing network and everyone would buy because I'm awesome. And that's not at all the case. it's a very humbling experience getting rejected by people who are close friends. And then suddenly you realize, wait a second, there's a difference when you become a vendor as opposed to like someone who's, you know, a professional colleague within your industry, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You actually do make a good point there. Right? I think a lot of people think sales is a dirty word, but the most effective security people are actually really good salespeople, because even if you're trying to communicate or convince people internally, because security, for the most part, is about change management. Like, if you have to change the way stuff is being done to be effective, and you've got to do a lot of internal selling. And if you talk about internal comms within the security team, or even outside of the security team, where you're trying to convince your dev team to write secure code or to value security, you're talking to a board and getting them to care, you are selling security as a function. And if you're not a good salesperson internally, it's very hard to be an effective security person. And the best security people are maybe not naturally good salespeople, but they've had to learn how to sell and market security internally, which I think may be where some of those skills just permeate into our skill set as we become more experienced and be more effective in our roles as we get older.
I guess I see a lot of people who do work in cybersecurity who are, you know, a little bit bitter and disappointed and really emotionally tied to, you know, the types of vulnerabilities that they encounter, and then the fact that businesses choose not to do things about them. And ultimately, I do feel like it comes down to a communications and sales problem. And if everyone's really willing to go out there and get your certifications, your qualifications, and at the end of the day, the person who actually signs off on these kind of things doesn't care if you have an OSCP or an OSCE or CISM, CISP, whatever.
Yep.
All he cares about, or they care about, is, does this matter for my business? How expensive is this going to be? And like, am I really at risk? What's important? Tell me something that means something to me, right?
Yeah.
And I always take that into my consulting nowadays, as I say that, you know, context is everything. So if I come across like a hard-coded credential, the first question I'm going to say is, hey, developers, instead of raising a high severity finding like a lot of people would do, I'd say, what are you using this for? And then they'll come back to me and say, well, it's a development because we're trying to test things really quickly, and it's hard for us to use the security provider tools like HashiCorp Vault or whatever. So we just can't put it into code so we can get it done quickly. In which case, yeah, it's, you know, not perfect, but at the end of the day, the context then says that this is for a test environment or a dev environment, and they're using it because we provided a bad user experience for the engineering teams. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like those kind of scenarios are why I have become and gravitated towards being a good salesperson over time, because I'm willing to listen to people about what their concerns are and then come back with a reasonable solution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I also heard a really good one there was about pushing to be uncomfortable. So what scenarios have you pushed yourself into to, you know, say, hey, yeah, this is my comfort zone, I'm going to really push myself out of, because I've got a lot of those myself.
I think every role I've taken has been slightly uncomfortable. And it was done, I think, deliberately that way. I'm not saying I went and deliberately looked for new roles. I think sometimes roles will just come to you, as happens in security, particularly nowadays. But you have a decision to make there whether you want to go pursue it or go, no, that's not for me. I tended to not try to do roles where it was the same as the role I was doing. So we talked about early on in my career at IBM, it was mostly technical. But even within IBM, I had three different roles. I did security consulting a little bit, and I realized that my skill set for communication needed to be built out a little bit. So I actively went and sought a different role within IBM to move to the software sales side of the business. It was still in security, but then I thought, like, why don't I try out how to sell something? And then I joined the IBM software group and sold the identity access management suite for IBM. That was, the identity access management was kind of a comfort zone for me, because that was a lot of what it was delivering. But the whole trying to sell it for IBM and dealing with the software of Tilbury and so on was a little bit outside my comfort zone. And the selling part was absolutely outside of my comfort zone. So that's one example. Moving into different areas, I think you talk about being much more external facing. Probably the most uncomfortable thing for some people is public speaking. Having to do sales and being in that kind of evangelistic role is absolutely public speaking. And if you want to shy away from that, it's not something that's very comfortable, right? Most people say that they have a bigger fear of public speaking than a lot of other things. So I really didn't like public speaking in high school, and it was something I had forced myself to do very publicly. And then the nth degree of that is to to deal with media. So a little bit later in my career, I took roles where it was very much outward facing kind of roles on top of all the stuff I did internally, right? I had APAC related roles both for IBM and at NetIQ. And I had to do things like speak with Sky News and CNBC and Bloomberg and the ABC News and Channel 7, etc., which is very scary from a person who had never done it before. Because the first time I had to do that was I was sitting there going, hang on a minute, this is national news and it's in there for perpetuity. I better not screw it up. So those are just a handful of examples where I deliberately sought roles that would give me both a way to build out my skill set, to be a little bit uncomfortable. At the same time, the payoff is very high if you do it well. Obviously, the risk that you take is that you don't do it very well. But ultimately, the biggest risk I think I've ever taken, maybe similar in terms of their pay packet, and obviously the success and demise, hopefully, which never happens to anyone who does all the right things, rests very much with the good decisions that you make and sometimes the bad decisions that you make. And it's going to come down to, okay, what's your risk appetite for being able to do that versus sitting in corporate and having a very safe job that pays you a salary?
I think that there's a lot to unpack there. So risks, I feel like actually starting a company is not as big a risk as people seem to think, because the worst case scenario generally is that you'll declare bankruptcy and then you'll go find a stable corporate job within a few weeks probably, right? And yeah, it might take you a bit of time to get on top of some of your director obligations if you, I don't know, screw up with your GST payments or something. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's too bad if you start off small. It's just if you grow too fast and then it becomes really unmanageable, then that's a big problem because you are affecting other people. But, you know, I encourage people to start businesses and actually learn what it's like, because if you want to be a better security professional, right, you need to be able to speak the language that basically business stakeholders use. And if you understand terms like, you know, cash flow management and your total addressable market and what your go-to-market strategy is and so on, you can have far better conversations than if you turn up just throwing cross-site scriptings at people and then hoping that they understand what that means, right? I actually really hate cross-site scripting. It should just be called content injection, but whatever. The public speaking thing really is something that I really understand quite personally too.
Mm.
When I was in high school, I remember getting up in front of like, I think a year 9 or 8 class. And it's a topic I really loved. It's again, ancient history. So it's funny you bring up the owl earlier. So I'm really, really into Greek mythology at that point in time.
Yeah.
And I just needed to just talk about a few things that happened then. And it was like, I can't remember exactly what, but basically it felt like a Sisyphean task, if you've heard of that before.
Yep.
Pushing that rock up the hill indefinitely. So I ended up getting up there and stuttering in front of everyone and just saying like, stuff this, and just walking out the room upset with myself. Got a big fat 0 for public speaking, and my parents very angry with me about that. So I guess over the years, I just kind of recognized that, why am I so bad at this? Why am I an awful public speaker? There's got to be a reason for it. And then I just pushed myself into positions that were increasingly baby steps, but getting better at practicing being in front of an audience, talking about things. And it started off like at university, you know, taking the lead on group assignments, or going to at the ATO, having regular sessions with development teams to say, this is what cross-site scripting is or whatever. I would do it badly and I would never like it because I just wasn't good at public speaking at that point in time. But then over time, you know, you do build those skills up, and you get to a point where you're like, actually now I have no problem going to meetups or conferences and standing in front of hundreds of people and saying, hello, I am a giant galah. Let's have fun.
Yeah, I think you make a good point, right? A lot of times, ultimately, it's about the old adage, just one step at a time. It is a bit of a cliche, but it's true. If you have a task that's too big and daunting in front of you, you would just never do it. For the most part, it's a mental block. So if you think about breaking it up, you could actively decide to make that step one at a time to eventually get there. And that's same for business. You take one step at a time. You don't need to do big bang because, yeah, big bang, like you alluded to, sometimes can end in disaster from a business standpoint, obviously not disaster in the truest sense.
I see a lot of security people who do want to start businesses, and they're thinking themselves, oh, I need to, you know, they create themselves a task, like a list of infinite tasks to be able to actually start the business, right?
Hmm.
Have you ever heard of yak shaving before?
No, but I'm sure you can enlighten us on that.
So It's a software engineering story. I'm not going to be able to retell it very well, but basically a guy needs to change a light bulb or something, right? And then he realizes, oh, I need to get my ladder from my neighbors to go up to get my light bulb. And then you realize that to get that, you forgot to give a tool back to the neighbor. So then he needs to drive the car, but then you forgot that your other neighbor's car, you made a mistake and you need to go help him out. So you go pick up some fuel. And then by the time you've done like 30 actions, you're going to go shave a yak so that you can get stuffing for the pillow so you can give it to the neighbor so you can take his car to go get a light bulb, right?
Yeah.
And then the idea is that if you're, you know, making a list of tasks like this so that you can actually do the one thing that matters, which honestly, if you're looking to change a light bulb, it could just be as simple as just going downstairs and getting a lamp or using a flashlight on your phone, which is more important if you need light in that room, than doing 50 different things, actually avoid doing the task that you really need to be doing, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like as software engineers, we always go for perfection first. So we just tend to yak shave most problems. Like, I guess with a business, actually the probably easiest one to think about is like a gym routine, right? My view is just go to the gym and pick things off randomly. And then that's better than sitting there planning a routine, planning a diet meal, like diets, and then thinking about checking your form for every single machine. I just think if you just go in there and just sit on the bike for 10 minutes, that's the best way to start. Or if you, you know, do rowing for 20 minutes, do that. And with businesses, I see the same thing. I'm going to make a website. I need to get my marketing collateral ready. I need business cards. I need to get my CRM sorted. And it's like, no. You don't need all of this to start. Like all I did when I started is just walk up to people at meetup groups and say, hello, do you want application security? And they're like, lol, go away. So
yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between starting a business and having children, right?
Yeah.
If you ask anyone who's ever had kids, were you ready? Because some people wait, I want to wait till I'm ready. Same for business. I want to wait till I'm ready. I want to wait for the right time. But for those of us who are parents, we're both parents, like you're never really ready to have a kid. You just, you work it out along the way. And the same can be said for starting a business, whether it's a side hustle or your main gig. It's like, I don't think you're ever really ready. You get ready by doing it. That's really the only way to do it. And because there are things that you have to learn along the way that you're never going to be able to write on a piece of paper to tick off that you've done, because you're not going to be able to do it till you actually do it.
I swear to, like, reading all of the... you know, Y Combinator stuff. Like, it was all nice and helpful and all of that. But at the end of the day, the most important things that I learned from just actually doing it and like being a dad, you know, it's, I had like a whole book of like what to expect when expecting. And then another one's like what to expect in the first year. And I think I read the first chapter of each and then realized that, you know, I should just like take care of my wife and just start, just do tasks, right?
Like, yeah.
Feed the baby, change the nappy. It's like, you learn these things as you become, you know, a parent. It's not, and I've seen a lot of people in their careers actually choose to delay children for a long time because they don't feel like they're ready for it. I actually know a lot of people around my age group who've specifically chosen to say they're not going to have kids until their mid-30s or late, like early 40s. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, well, like, when will you be ready? What's the stability look like? So how did you go with like having kids? Because I made a very specific time frame where I said at 30, that's when I'm going to have my kids, right? For me, I didn't want to be too old, so I couldn't be an active grandparent. And I didn't want to be too young where I didn't have enough financial surety with my career at the same time, right? So that's kind of where my benchmark was. But what about you?
I think we had a similar mindset. It was a whole, yeah, how old do you want to be able to play your grandkids, right? So you've kind of got a window there. I suppose the first question is, do you actually want kids? Not everybody wants kids.
Yeah.
We did. But at the same time, I think, I live in the UK for a little bit, so I think we probably didn't want to bring a kid into the world while we were kind of not at home. So I think we also had to be at home while we did it. So it was either going to be really early on or had to be after that. So to a certain extent, that was kind of the time frame to be stable to a point where it could feel like home, and we had a support system around us, you know, the grandparents, the brothers and sisters and the aunties and uncles and all kind of stuff. And the support network, I think was useful. We obviously had the whole, are we ready to do this kind of discussion a little bit younger? But then as, you know, like we were just talking about, as you get older, you realize you're never really going to do that. So all you can do is make sure that your comfort level is sufficient, or you may not feel ready. And that if for whatever reason, certain things don't happen the way you planned out, you've got the support around you and there's nothing like being home to do it. So I think that was probably the main thing we had to get our minds around before we went, you know what, that makes sense now.
So there you go. same thing with businesses and starting families. Just do it. Give it a go. See how it is.
Pretty much. I don't want to tell people they don't need to do any planning. You obviously have to think about it. You can do some research. You and I both did some research, but you research to a point so that you don't go in completely clueless. But at the same time, you don't need to be a PhD in whatever the topic is to do it, right?
Yeah, I think people overanalyze everything.
Yep.
Even going back to like what we're saying about being uncomfortable with something, right? You can jump in the deep end with absolutely no research. And I think that that's actually not necessarily a great thing to be doing. I still think there's a healthy level of planning that you need to do. You should get at least some floaties on before you jump in the pool, right? If you've never done swimming before.
Absolutely. You have to do your homework. Like I'm always an advocate of doing homework, but you don't have to do your homework to the point where you have to make you only want to do it if you are sure you're going to get 100% on all the exams.
Moving to a different topic, I'd like to chat a bit about your business, actually, because I know that it's a software as a service company and it deals with managing risk.
Yep.
But otherwise, I'm pretty new to it. I see you stand at lots of events, so you're clearly doing a lot of marketing. Can you tell me a bit about like where you started and why you felt there was a gap in the market to create Avertro?
Yeah, I think I alluded to it earlier in my career. I was in identity and access management. Security has always been a very technical pursuit. It continues to be. It's still important that we understand security is a technical pursuit. But given what we've seen of late, I think executives, boards, leaders, it's become much more mainstream. As security professionals, we probably keep saying to people, it's always been mainstream, just no one noticed. But if you talk about the zeitgeist and what really shows up in the main tier one newspapers and news outlets, it's really only been the last couple of years where it's become that level of visibility for boards and executives. Now, in my roles at EY, McAfee, I think that really started to become really clear to me. So there was a lot of work I was doing in those kinds of roles where there's some things that the ecosystem can provide for you for executive and board and leadership visibility and understanding around security, right? You can get consulting help, which I literally did for people when I was at EY. You can get some technology help, but there's technology where you can piecemeal it together, where you can use multiple kinds of technology alongside the consulting help, alongside the people you can hire to try and solve a problem. But ultimately, there was still a gap between what execs and stakeholders had in terms of trying to make decisions versus what security teams could provide for them in a way that makes sense. You kind of alluded to it. You've got to be able to speak the language of business if you're trying to tell a board or an executive that isn't a security expert why it matters, why you need certain amounts of money, why you need to do certain initiatives, why AppSec's important, for example. And the operational way that teams were being forced to do it, in my mind, just wasn't efficient. So I saw a gap in the market as I was about to start Avertro, where we needed to operationalize the business of cyber, so to speak, right? Which involves risk management, involves compliance, involves strategic management, involves communication, involves reporting, all of the above. And because I had to literally do it for people manually, and I also had to listen to people complain to a certain extent to me about how inefficient the system was and how they were being forced to do it, I thought there's a way for us to build a system that ties everything together in a manageable way. So we've evolved the system over the years. We're about 3.5 years old now, but where we first started was more optimizing for how can we just optimize for helping people communicate this better in an operationalized, sustainable, repeatable, defensible way. And that was the impetus for why we started Avertro, to solve what we solve for and for the mission that we're on. Mission hasn't really changed. What has changed, obviously, is the market's changed a little bit. The way we've been able to listen to the market and iterate on how we solve for this problem has changed a little bit. So that's why we exist, and that's why we are still going.
It's really cool that you've been able to recognize that what you built 3.5 years ago is not what is necessarily the same now, and you needed to go kind of pivot and change your focus. Why did you have to move? Was it because the fact that the compliance changed, or that there wasn't product market fit, or the market itself is just, it's in a downturn, so it's hard to do cyber sales? Like, what's driving these core product changes for you?
I don't think any company ever gets a product market fit within the year one. So we didn't expect we were at product market fit in the first year. All we had to do was have a hypothesis for what could get our first couple of customers, which we did in various ways. But then if you don't adapt to the market, you probably won't be able to serve your first customers very well moving forward. Secondarily, yes, I think the market changed, the pandemic had a lot to do with it. People's appetite for what they wanted to spend on security change over time, no matter what area of security you're in, whether it's AppSec or risk management or governance and compliance or SecOps or whatever else, right? These things will always change. So as a product-driven company, we have to iterate on what the market is telling us, what our customers are telling us. There's no sense us being on and going on an academic side saying, it would be cool to build ABC, and then you build it and then people sit there and go, that looks very cool, but I can't use it. It's not practical. So there's a lot of pragmatism that goes into what you evolve. When we say pivot, I don't think we don't really pivot in the macro sense. Like I said, our mission hasn't changed, but what you need to do is you have to pivot little micro capabilities to either adapt to what people want or how they use it. I think I said earlier on, security for the most part is about change management, meaning you can't completely shift how somebody does something and get in the throat all the way. All you can do is get the change what they do to be more efficient. And that's how we've had to adapt what we do over time, and also just make sure that people are getting the most value out of what we're providing versus that sounds cool, looks great, but I can't use it.
So what lessons have you learned for aspiring security SaaS startup founders? What would you give us some advice?
I would say leave your ego at the door, I think.
Yep.
Security people sometimes think we know best. By sometimes, I mean all the time. We always sit there lamenting the fact people aren't listening to us and why is it so hard to get people to care, et cetera, et cetera. There's psychology behind all of it. But if you leave your ego at the door, then you're more willing to listen to what's going to move the needle on what we're trying to get at. Because ultimately, a security professional, if you leave your ego at the door, you can realize, okay, here's the impact we're trying to make. Here's the outcomes we're trying to get. It is not a perfect world. So there has to be some level of compromise in the middle. And ego gets in the way of making actual real change. And as a security industry, we're not very good at leaving our ego at the door because of the brick wall we've been banging our head against for the last 30, 40 years or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, it's not working very well, is it?
No.
The approach of go back to ancient Greece, because I guess that's all I'm on about nowadays is just talking about that. I can't even remember who said it, but he said, I am the wisest of the Greeks because I know that I know nothing, right?
Yep.
And I feel like taking that approach, I guess, again, going back to my AppSec background, what I know is that every developer is smarter than I am. So I can go up to them and say, hey, you have SQL injection. And then they'll say, did you read the documentation for SQLize? And I said, no. And they're like, well, maybe you should. Then I learn that if there's only a few areas within SQLize that are actually got injectable parameters, right?
Okay.
So I feel like since I've been humbled, eaten a lot of crow many times in my career, that I'm now come into pretty much every conversation and say, hey, I probably don't know this as well as you, but how about you tell me more about it? So I guess it applies with your startups as well. Cause when you're saying leave ego at the door, is this more from a, I'm going to build a product and people will think the product is great? Or is it more the sales side of you need to buy this because you have problems or just everywhere?
I think it's more the product side of things. Obviously, if you're a sales approach that relies on ego, you're probably not going to be very successful because people must like you if you're selling. But I think a lot of the mistakes that are made when you're trying to build a product is that the product managers or whoever the leader of that product is think they know best. And the graveyard of products that nobody uses are littered with people who had big egos. They just thought they knew best. There's only so many people who can be Steve Jobs or Henry Ford or Elon Musk in terms of having a vision where maybe the market doesn't agree with you, but you've got this insight. The often quoted thing from Henry Ford, I think, which is if he'd asked the market what they wanted, they would have said faster horses, not cars. Now, that's really an edge case, right? When you're building a product, for most part, you have to make sure that you still remain. The hardest part of product management is remaining on your track that you want to get to and understanding what your goals and your mission is. You shouldn't deviate from that too much, but how you get there is going to change. It is not a straight line. It is a very, very jagged line where you have to listen to people and take that input and understand that sometimes you're not right. As long as you're not completely changing what you're doing that had nothing to do with your mission in the first place, you have to be able to take that input and then inject and ingest that into your product management and build process so that you can really provide something of value that people will be able to use.
I guess like a lot of startups are really incentivized to grow at all costs in the past. And that meant that when you were doing those kind of making those kind of decisions, you basically had the money to spend on anything, right? Just whatever sticks, just do it, right? And I feel like that's absolutely flipped around nowadays. So like pragmatic expenditure and being actually able to think about the fundamentals and how you're sustainably going to grow the business is what I'm seeing is becoming a lot more important. Are you finding that that's the same when you talk to your investors?
Today, yes. If we talk about the excesses of 2021 and where people just throw money at something at ridiculous valuations, we probably didn't get enough credit for doing that. We've always built Avertro to be a sustainable business. We have raised VC money, so we do have the VC side of things to deal with. At the same time, we've been very careful not to lean into the excesses and crazy startup type valuations and narratives, so to speak. So we've been able to have the benefits that come with being VC funded, but at the same time, not be headed off the cliff because we are burning way too much cash like so many startups were doing in 2021, 2022. And we saw what happened with those, right? You've got these startups to raise a heap of money and you're sitting there going, how did they run out of that money in 12 to 18 months? Because they spent way too much money in unsustainable ways. So I think we've been very sustainable along the way and we're finally getting some credit for it today, which I'm very, very pleased about, obviously.
It's good to see a successful cybersecurity company that's been able to, you know, just slowly grow over time and be able to respond to changing market dynamics and not just burn through a pile of VC money and crash and burn. So I see a lot in the AppSec space, like the last couple of years, where they've just gone and invented something to solve things. And then they've somehow said their total addressable market's like 50 million, like 500 million or something. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, mate, that's like global sales for the entire sector. Not even, yeah, of course it's your TAM, but you can't replace every AppSec product globally in all markets at all points in time. You are silly to even go to your investors and say that.
I mean, that's always the balance you're making, right? They want entrepreneurs to have ambition. So you kind of have to show them that you have ambition, but at the same time, there's a level of realism you have to inject in that. I mean, that's probably one of the things I learned through this journey. Very early on, I think I felt I had to show that ambition. So some of the early numbers that we always threw out there happened to be quite huge, maybe not as unrealistic as that. But as time's gone on, I think I've learned to be more pragmatic and realistic about things. Sometimes that will mean certain investors will say your ambition doesn't seem big enough. But I think the good VCs or the good investors will understand that pragmatism is going to take you further than pretending you're going to sell to the whole market and replace everything.
I guess it just depends on like what kind of investors you want to attract, right? Mm. One of my friends worked for an Australian company that took a lot of VC funding.
Yeah.
And the VC funding's whole thing was to say, you now need to expand globally immediately, right? And the unfortunate thing that they had to do is that they couldn't actually use their product in the US because the way that the product worked was fundamentally different than how Australia does it. So they had to re-architect it from scratch and that burnt through almost all capital and then no one even used it in the US, right? Now they're in a situation where they have to go and merge with another company locally to actually be competitive moving forward. So you'll be able to read about it in the AFR in a month, I'm sure. So
yeah, that's the danger sometimes with having that external funding and them having too much control. So we've been very careful.
Yeah, good to hear. So we're getting to the end of the interview. I'd like to ask a few quick round questions for you, if you like.
Absolutely.
All right. So number one, best purchase for under $100 and why?
I'll give you a book, actually. So it's an old book. It's Start With Why by Simon Sinek.
Okay.
It's one of the most impactful books I've ever read. And I think it shaped the thinking for what we do. It also changed a lot of people's thinking, including my own, those years ago when I read it. This still continues to be one of my key book recommendations. And I think you can buy it for $20 now.
I feel like I'm going to have to get like a self-help secured podcast book list because, you know, I've had, Dale Carnegie recommended a few times. I've had Mark Manson with The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. I've had Tim Ferriss, Tools of Titans, just Everyone's got like their own like special one that inspires and motivates people to move forward.
Yep.
I think I haven't read Start With Why, but I've read Leaders Eat Last. So
yep.
So Simon Sinek, so definitely someone who's pretty good there.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be, my second question was actually going to be, what book would you recommend and why? But I feel like we've already got that one, so covered.
I did 2 and 1. Talk about efficiency.
Too bloody good at this. I need to think of a third question for you now, man.
Okay.
How about for people who are aspiring to start a company, what would be the one thing they should focus on and why?
Who's going to pay you for it? Because there's no sense. I think we can encourage entrepreneurialism. We can encourage the risk-taking. We probably need more entrepreneurs in Australia. At the same time, you're not going to get very far if you can't figure out who's going to pay for it. And what I mean there is that you have to do your... If you make a decision to start a company, you have to go and speak to people. You alluded to the fact you went around and spoke to people, right? You've got to speak to people and adapt your approach to make sure that you are solving a real need. And one of the biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make is that they don't solve a real need. So do your homework, figure out who's going to pay for it, and then optimize for that.
Yeah. I've seen many people make that mistake before, where they're just like, I'm going to do security consulting. I'm like, have you worked out who?
Yeah.
You're going to sell to?
Exactly.
And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, good luck.
Yeah.
Cool. And one last question is, for people who are just moving into cybersecurity, what advice would you give them?
I would say be bold. Like a rat I was talking to earlier, right? He deliberately went and did his homework to figure out what kind of companies he wanted to work for, and then he took action. And that took a level of boldness that you don't normally see in people. And the most effective people, I think, and the most growth you see in people are the people who are willing to be bold.
Yes, I've had that a few times. Some of my staff members, one of them drove 2.5 hours up to come meet me in person for a beer on a Friday afternoon. And then I was like, okay, cool. You genuinely are committed to actually driving a few hours up from Sydney to Newcastle just to meet me for a beer, right?
Yep, absolutely.
That shows commitment to me. And I now actually do that myself with a lot of clients, is I'm going to actively make the trip to Sydney or to Canberra or to wherever to go meet people in person, because I want to show that I value their time and I value them as a person. And
yeah, that's right.
I love video conference, but I guess me and you'll have to catch up for a beer in the future.
We will do. Either find you in person.
Okay. Hey, Ian, thank you so much for coming on to Secured. I really appreciate it. Any parting words for our audience?
My parting words are be comfortably uncomfortable. We said it a few times. I think that'll serve you in good stead, whether you're trying to be an entrepreneur or whether you're trying to expand your career or just in life in general, right? You grow in being uncomfortable.
All right. Thanks, mate. Thanks for coming on.
No worries, Cole.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galahcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode. If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage, and I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.